This week on Writers, Inc.
Celebrate every single win. When I would get, you know, when I'd send out short stories, if I get a hold on it, as in, like, they may still reject it later, but they at least want to hold it for consideration, I celebrate that. If you get a request from an agent, celebrate that.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out, school's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I was trying to do the math here. Were you guys part of the podcast when all this drama with my neighbors started? I think this was even predates all of you.
Part of it. I think it even predates us. Yeah.
Okay.
I've been here for a big chunk, though.
The Cliff Notes version for the people that have been following along is when we bought our house, we learned that a tiny little sliver of our front yard, it's 178 square feet, actually belonged to our neighbors because of a weird, you know, like the way they had to draw the lot lines. And we have what's called a permanent easement over that spot. And it's very one-sided. The document basically says that the neighbors own the land, but they're not allowed to touch it. And we get to basically control it from landscaping and maintenance and all that kind of fun stuff. That was part of our closing documents when we bought the house. And immediately after we moved in here, our neighbors started to violate it. They started putting lawn chairs out there and like sitting out there. And then at one point they put up stakes and tried to rope it off. But I had to take them to court to enforce this easement deed. And this dates all the way back to like when Jay was on the podcast. So probably like the beginning of Writers, Inc. when this all started. It took about 3.5 years, but we finally got a ruling. I won on basically every aspect of the case. Then my neighbors listed their house for sale. And they closed and moved out like as of 2 days ago. So like we've got brand new neighbors.
Wow.
The whole street feels so much lighter right now.
It's so amazing because it's so obvious that they were just like planning on essentially bullying the new neighbor into like, no, this is our house, and like not expecting you to fight back, which is like so weird.
Yeah, it's a weird thing.
It was expensive though too. Like I spent about $200,000 in legal fees.
Sued
the town. They sued the town over this too, because the town was involved, and they spent $100,000. And I've got no idea what the neighbors actually spent, but you know, probably about $500,000 on the table over, you know, them just basically not honoring something that was in place. And like when the judge saw it, I mean, basically his ruling was, you know, here's the document. It's very specific. This is what you can and can't do. And, you know, it was what we all knew, and they were violating it all along. But yes, I mean, some people are just, they're assholes. You know, you gotta
they had enough of your shenanigans and pitched and pulled up stakes and
that was the best part. I really wanted to sit on my porch and just kind of watch the moving trucks come and go. You know, just watching them fill up the trucks with all their things and then and just leave was just fantastic.
I want to know what went through their lawyer's head, because like they had to have looked at this and been like, oh, we're going to lose. Like there's no way they looked at it and were like, I can beat this. So
they make money either way.
Well, yeah, I know, but
they had multiple lawyers from start to finish, and a lot of them just walked, like wouldn't take the case. And you know, like their first lawyer was, you know, like kind of involved at the fringe at the beginning, and then he walked away, and then they had to get somebody else and somebody else. You know, so they finally landed on, you know, basically a glorified ambulance chaser. You know, somebody who's willing to take whatever case he can to pay his bills. You know, he doesn't care.
Yeah. Well, they'd have to.
Yeah. So have you met the new neighbors though? That's the real question.
Same as the old neighbors.
Have they moved in yet?
No, nobody's moved in yet. We haven't seen anybody over there. It's been, you know, a couple days, you know, since they took possession, but all we've heard is that they're from Massachusetts, you know, so that could be anything. They might be 10 minutes away, or they might be, you know, 2 hours away. But hopefully sometime soon, we're hoping they have kids.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, for everybody who's been, you know, following along with the drama for all these years, that's the ultimate outcome.
Yes.
Kevin, you've got drama going on today too, right? Did you release like a novella or something?
Yeah, I dropped a new novella, like a sci-fi novella this morning. I'm kind of watching the little sales.
What
climb up. And it was really a rewrite of I had done a short story for an anthology like a decade ago, and I'm starting to kind of go through all my old short stories and novellas and novel starters and things, and just kind of retooling and re-releasing and having a good time with it. So, but the other something else that happened yesterday was actually kind of cool. It was a brand new experience for me. Oh, and by the way, you can find that novella. It's Rover 8, available on Amazon.
Plug that
go and buy
in.
that. Yesterday, I keep getting advice from people to try dictation. Kevin J. Anderson has tried to talk me into it, and Nick Thacker, and we had a guest. I had a guest on the Wordslinger podcast who tried to get me into it, and I just never can pull it off. I ran into a guy, the incoming president for NINC, while I was at NINC last week,
Oh,
named
yeah.
Kevin McLaughlin. He does this. He dictates, and he showed me his really super elaborate setup. And so on a whim yesterday, I'm walking my dog, and I think, I'm just gonna try it. I popped in my AirPods, started using the voice memo thing, and it does a transcript. So that comes in real handy. But I just fired off a real quick flash fiction story, probably not even 1,000 words, and just for the fun of it, I posted it on my Substack, and it has just blown up. Like I've gotten so many people pop in and comment on that thing, and of course they want to see more. It's too short, they want to see more. So I'm like, this is a great way to kind of test weird ideas, because the premise of this one was it's called the Library of Unwritten Books, and it's the idea of like
Nice.
all those book ideas you've ever had that you never wrote down, never got around to, the shower ideas and stuff. They exist as fully fleshed out books in this library of unwritten books, and this author stumbles across some of his unwritten books,
Oh,
and
that's cool.
where we go from there is probably coming up soon, because I started writing a fleshed out version of that story this morning.
Fun.
So
Nice.
yeah, so I think
Cool.
that's a fun thing. I'll probably do more of that, but it was a proof of concept for the dictation thing, and which apparently I can do much better than I thought. I mean, it came out exactly as I said it. I mean, I didn't change a word of it.
Cool.
How
Interesting.
exactly does that play out? Did you just leave the dictation software open like the whole time you were walking the dog? So like awkward silences and all that are in there and
Cars going by. And what I did was, so voice memo on the iPhone creates a transcript, and it's pretty accurate. What I did was grab that, took it into ChatGPT, and said, "Hey, clean this up and put in the quotations for dialogue and break it into paragraphs and all that. Clean it up for me." And it did that, and I read through it. I lied. I changed one word from the transcript to the final product, but it did a brilliant job of formatting it. Didn't change anything. Didn't go screwy. So, nice clean story.
Nice.
I'm sorry, I'm interested in the technical side of this.
Tell me,
Does
ask
it
me.
time out at some point, or it'll just let you keep this open indefinitely?
Good question. I don't know how long a voice memo can run. This was maybe 10 minutes of me walking,
Oh, okay.
with the dog. But I've heard. I think Nick Thacker uses this same app, and he dictates while he's driving, like from Denver to Austin. And you can do multiple files, but he dictates for long stretches. I don't know if there's a limit to how long you can go, but I can check. I can find out.
Yeah.
I'm
I
just
want to
curious
try
because I
that.
could see like leaving this open, like you just said on a drive, like you're driving for 4 hours, so maybe leave it open the whole time and then you just talk when you come up with whatever. Like I do about an hour every day.
There is no set time limit for voice memos on iPhone. The recording length is limited only by your device's available storage space.
Oh, and
So
see,
there
I
you
have a
go.
my iPhone is 2 terabytes, so
That's a big one.
that's a big
Wow.
one.
Holy
Or is it
smokes.
1 terabyte? It's at least a terabyte. I don't remember. Maybe it's not two, but it's at least one. So I got plenty of space.
Plenty of space.
It does a great job. It did a fantastic job of actually transcribing and doing the and I stole the idea of taking it to ChatGPT from Kevin, because he has a there's like Mac Whisper or something like that. Is it's got ChatGPT sort of built into it, and it has this built-in prompt that basically tells ChatGPT to do what I told it to do. But I'm like, well, I don't need to spend money on app. I mean, I've got everything I need. So, and then I told it, remember this prompt so that next time I ask you to clean up a story, you'll do it this way. And so it'll be able to do it again later.
Cool.
So, yeah. I don't know about long format yet. I mean, I do a lot of looping back and referring to things, so I don't know if I'll be able to do like a truly long format, but a real quick flash fiction idea, something where I can kind of encapsulate in just a few paragraphs, and then that can spark something later. I mean, it worked great for that so far.
Well, I know Kevin Anderson goes on pretty lengthy walks, right? For a couple
Yeah.
hours or so at a time, like up in the mountains somewhere.
But he's got
And
a
it,
voice recorder, and he has a human being
right.
doing the transcription.
So he's still doing it that way. He hasn't crossed over to the 20.
Yeah, I don't think he's transitioned to using AI for that yet, but he maybe I we'll talk to him in November. We'll ask him, are you still doing it this
Yeah.
way? Or I'll send him an email after the show, because and everybody keeps trying to get me to do this, so I'm like, there must be some magic sauce to this because everybody's doing it.
All right.
So,
Speaking of that, which a totally awkward segue, like you always do, what is in the news?
you'll get better at it, JD. Speaking of awkward segues, at Pop, Publishing's finance minds share how strategy drives acquisitions. Finance leaders said they're partners to editors, not adversaries. They start with data, including author track record and comps, but try to make editor-backed projects work rather than veto them. Acquisitions are portfolio decisions. What's the return on investment and timeline? Who's the audience? And how will you reach them? Today, you need a concrete plan to reach an audience. An appearance on the Today Show is no longer enough of a strategy. I'll take it, though. They'll take calculated risks on strong editorial conviction, especially stories that can travel across formats, such as from podcast to audiobook to print, but aren't, quote, too wedded to the data in a creative business.
So these are basically all the things they're looking at before they decide whether it's even a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I do think is, I don't know, man. I do have a hang up about this. Like, I think you should start with, is it a good story? And then look at the rest of this stuff, not the other way around.
Yeah. They're saying, oh, we don't not publish a story because of financials, but then they kind of also do. What I thought was interesting, a couple of the things that I read in the article was when they were talking about ROI, they're saying if you can't show me a return on investment, then why are we publishing it? Which sounds like a financial decision to me. Or they said, or the cost for the investment needs to be quite low. So you know who's getting a low advance is going to be, yeah.
And here's what I think is funny. They won't touch something that's been indie published,
Yeah.
right?
Unless it's done like amazingly well.
Well, and it has to do like phenomenally well. But like I can break it down for you, as a marketing guy, like I can break it down for you what the ROI would be on a book, released by an indie published title. If it hits a certain number of sales, and even if it's only on Amazon, if it hit a certain number of sales, I could almost guarantee you that with the right sort of nurturing, that thing would blow up in a wider market with TradPub backing it. But they won't ever look at it, so it doesn't matter.
I'm just looking at these as benchmarks. And when I see benchmarks like this or a checklist, I basically, in today's world, see somebody creating a prompt. So, like, all of these things are going to go into a prompt, and nobody physically is going to look at any of this. They're going to draft that prompt, they're going to use it over and over again. And an AI is going to tell them whether they should even proceed. So, like, I think as an author, you kind of need to approach this the same way. Like, you need to look at each of these boxes, figure out where you stand and at least understand that, where you are in the scheme of things, because that's how they perceive you. You know, I talk to indie authors about this all the time, where people that, you know, like they query an agent, they don't get an agent, they get a bunch of rejections. So they just hit the publish button and put it up on Amazon themselves. And, you know, they end up, you know, they're like maybe a 2.3 rating overall. After, you know, after a while, it's ranked at a million something in the store. And then a year later, they come out with another book and query agents. And they don't realize just how much they hurt themselves with that first book, because now all of a sudden they've established this track record. And that second book they wrote might be the greatest book ever, but it doesn't matter, because the information that's available about them online is basically carved in stone. And that's what these guys are using to make the decision on the second book. And now it's going to, I can see this all getting automated. You know, like an editor is going to have something on his desk where he just plugs in a name and it's going to tell him whether he should even bother reading the rest of that query that just came in.
Right. Yeah. I think, though, indie authors would serve themselves by looking at lists like this and thinking about, you know, their own approach to marketing and their own approach to release in this light, even if they don't intend to ever try to get an agent.
Yeah.
Because if you are looking at it as like, it's an IP play, I'm going to write this book, but what are the other ways I can utilize this and turn it into something? And podcasts are an easy one. That's an easy loft, because it's just audio. But, you know, now with the way AI is, I mean, I'm watching crazy things happen with AI video, online. I mean, it's insane. There's a series I'm watching now. It's like a fan built Star Trek, The Next Generation. Like it's an additional season to that show. And it's weird. And because of, you know, you're looking at these familiar faces and they're not acting quite right, but it's close enough that I could say, like, in another couple of years, it'll be indistinguishable. Yeah. But I'm like, you don't need much of a budget or anything now to take your idea and convert it into something playable, put it on YouTube and monetize it.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things that one of the acquisitions financial people said, that I know this idea has been floating around, but I don't know that I've actually heard it from the trad side this way, was that they've been developing a strategy to look for stories that they can see first as a narrative series within a podcast. I don't think that I've ever heard that before. So, like, podcast, and then the second step would be audiobook. And they said they've been actually, like, actively building a pipeline for these ideas. So, like, I don't know. So think about your book as being a narrative podcast first, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Not a bad plan.
Yeah.
not a bad plan.
I do think, though, like, it is a good thing to, like you said, you know, like, look at different angles and stuff. But I think, going back to JD's original point, like, I do also think that you need to be very careful. I think the ease of publishing, especially in, like, self-publishing, and the ease of, like, AI and creating all these things, makes it very tempting to just hit that publish button. You know, if it doesn't do well, then it actually can hurt you more than it can help you. So I do think that, you know, even though it might be tempting to do that, and it's good to have a plan, but, like, really start to think about how you're going to market it and how you're going to do these things and how you're going to make sure that it does what you want it to do, before you press that button. Because I think that, you know, I mean, a podcast and all that is great, but again, you know, if it's not doing what you think it's going to do, it can potentially hurt you if your goal is to eventually go traditional published.
If you took one of your ideas and maybe you went ahead and wrote the book, but if you decided, you know what, I'm going to publish this as a podcast first and see how it does, that's not going to get counted against you, because they're looking at book sales numbers and rankings, things like that. But you could just release this thing as a podcast, and then at the end of the whole thing, you could offer the book. If it's doing well, you come out with, get the book.
I agree with that, because agents these days will Google you and they will see, like, oh, you only have, like,
you think an agent's going to turn down your book pitch because you didn't have a successful podcast?
Possibly, yeah.
Yes, especially if they're looking for their own traditional published podcast to audiobook pipeline. If they want to do that podcast and you've already done it, you might be in trouble.
I mean, this is, I think if you talk to agents, they would tell you, well, agents are pretty savvy, so they have a nice way of circling around the truth. But I do think that they would.
Because if you create all this stuff first, now you're taking that option off the table for the trad publisher. So if they wanted to do it, and all of a sudden you did it, and you did it in this half-assed way or a way that didn't perform, they're going to walk away. It's just very few indie published anything gets a second glance after it's already out. Like they have to be first to the table with every aspect of it, or they don't want to touch it.
Yeah, I do think that that's the truth, and I do think that that's why you need to be careful.
Yeah, you have to use the method I'm using, which is make yourself unignorable. Make yourself inevitable. All right. I am next the story. Thanos of publishing. All right, next up. You know, I'm tempted to skip ahead because we did mention Star Trek, but I'm gonna stick with the order here. So publishers warily await completion of ReaderLink B&T deal. ReaderLink is buying Baker & Taylor's assets only, leaving Baker & Taylor's debts behind. So publishers worry about unpaid invoices, and some are even weighing a class action to delay the deal. The target close is September 26th. A claims process for pre-closing invoices will start after the sale. But for now, there's a lot of uncertainty, and creditors may have little say in how money gets distributed. The upside, Baker & Taylor will keep operating with ReaderLink's resources, more inventory, and most staff in place under CEO Eamon Kocher, which could steady library supply even if feelings are mixed.
I'm trying to figure out how they're even pulling this off. I guess they haven't gone into bankruptcy or anything.
I don't know. So this is a thing now. This is something that's happening a lot now with companies somehow buying.
If you think about the business, like if they haven't gone into bankruptcy, they can sell whatever asset they have.
Right.
You know, so they're basically doing that first. You know, they were heading towards bankruptcy. So that's where they were going. But if they had filed, they wouldn't be able to do this because all the assets would be frozen. Then they would be liquidated. Creditors would be taken care of based on those liquidations.
Yeah.
So they're basically liquidating, putting the cart in front of the horse, I guess. But I could see the creditors themselves stopping this.
Yeah. I actually think that this shouldn't be allowed. I think that companies are, if you've got those kind of debts, you know, your obligation is the first offer has to be to those you are indebted to. If the debt is large enough, you could convert that into shares in the company and then when the sale happens, they get repaid automatically. But that's somehow these companies are getting, and Disney did this. Disney did this with the Star Wars franchise. Like they bought a bunch of the big chunk of the Star Wars like ancillary products and stuff without taking on any debt. That's how you ended up with Alan Dean Foster getting screwed out of any royalties for his Star Wars novelizations that they based some of the films on. Mm. So this feels slimy to me. It feels like there's a loophole here that needs to be closed or not.
I think we all agree with you.
Okay.
Nothing else to be said.
Speaking of stars and wars and related items, this is not a Star Wars reference, but LeVar Burton named ABA's Indie Bookstore Ambassador. LeVar Burton of Star Trek The Next Generation fame and also Reading Rainbow fame, let's just throw that in there, has been named the American Booksellers Association's Indie Bookstore Ambassador for 2025-2026. He'll spotlight indies on Small Business Saturday, November 29th, 2025, and Independent Bookstore Day, April 25th, 2026. Burton is the longtime Reading Rainbow host, director of the 2023 documentary, The Right to Read, author of Aftermath and children's books, and winner of Peabody, a Grammy, 7 NAACP awards, and 15 Emmys, including a Lifetime Achievement Award. His message to readers, independent bookstores are, quote, sanctuaries of possibility, where a single story can change a life, and he's out to champion them nationwide.
I love this so much. I love LeVar Burton.
I love it too.
Butterfly in the sky. Yeah.
Wasn't he almost the host of Jeopardy at one point?
Was he?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
I thought that he was on deck or like one of the short list when Alec Trebek was
I don't know.
Did they do that thing? Didn't they do that thing where they brought in like guest hosts and, you know, every week there was, or maybe every month there was
another host?
They
always have celebrities on and stuff. Yeah. But I don't know if you've ever listened to his podcast, LeVar Burton Reads. It's fantastic. If you have not, he picks a sci-fi or fantasy story just because he loves it and he reads it. And it's amazing.
That's fun.
Yeah. I've seen that. I learned about it. I don't remember who it was, but an author realized that he read their story and was just like, "Oh my God."
Well, it wasn't me.
No.
So screw you, LeVar Burton.
Hey.
No,
We love
I
you,
could
LeVar
never.
Burton.
We love LeVar
Kevin's
Burton.
fire.
I would love to interview him for the show at some point. We need to
Yeah,
get
that'd
on
be
that.
awesome.
JD, you know everybody. Push some buttons.
Don't know LeVar Burton. Challenge accepted, though. I'll
I'm
track
actually
him down.
connected to, I'm 1 degree of separation away from him. I wonder if I could pull the screen.
We're gonna count on
Because
you now. Yeah.
I'm good friends with Vic Mignogna. And actually I've been tentative friends with a couple of Tim Russ and a couple other Star Trek actors. So maybe I can swing it.
Well, it'd be super cool to know what being an indie bookstore ambassador is about. I would love to hear that interview. So we're counting on you now, Kevin.
Okay, well now I gotta go put my money where my
The
mouth
race is
is.
on. Who can get the LeVar Burton interview first, JD or Kevin? Or will it be the prize win by Christine herself? Stay tuned.
My money's on Jenna. All
What
right,
me?
well.
I didn't even throw my hat in the ring.
I didn't say anything. You threw my hat in the ring, so thank you.
right, well, that's all the news we should get on to. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right, with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Kelsea Yu on. Kelsea is a Shirley Jackson award-winning author of several novellas. She's published over a dozen short stories. Her latest book is called Demon Song. It's a gothic horror inspired by Chinese mythology, and it releases September 30th. Here she is, Kelsea Yu.
Well, thanks so much for being here. It's so nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here. Thanks
Yeah,
for having me.
you've had a good year this year. A lot going on. I know last time we talked about sort of your writer origin story and how you got started. So I thought this time, a slightly different approach to that question would be, what's been your favorite part of your writing journey so far?
Oh man, favorite part is a hard one. I mean, there's a lot of little moments here and there that are always really exciting, but I think overall, okay, this is going to sound a little bit cheesy, but overall, it's the community. It's just like I feel like especially over the last year or so, I've really gotten to know my local author community, and I just feel like, I don't know, there's nothing quite like finding people who are in this really weird industry with you, who, understand everything you're going through and just like they get it and they, I don't know, the support, I guess, from other authors is probably my favorite thing. Just like meeting all these cool people who are writing these awesome things, like, I don't know. That's my favorite
Yeah.
part. I just went to WorldCon actually, and
Oh, fun.
I got to meet so many people in person whom, I hadn't had the chance to meet in real life before, and I don't know, it's really invigorating, I guess.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that because, when you're getting started, I think that's probably the hardest part. For new authors, right? Because, like, you know how it goes. Like, you talk to someone who's not in publishing, and you're like, "Oh, I'm writing a book," and they're like, "Oh, when can I buy it?" And you're like, "I don't know, maybe never."
Yeah, like maybe never, maybe in 5 years, who knows?
Yeah, can't, and they just always look at you, like you've sprouted horns or something. Like, what do you mean? Like, can't I just buy it on Amazon? And you're like, not how it works.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that really takes a long time to build, and I think it could be very frustrating along the way when you haven't found it yet. But I also feel like now, in the day of, the internet, there's a lot of places where we can find community, even if like I said, I obviously really appreciate my local community, but I also talk to a lot of authors online purely, and there's so much to be had there too. Like, that's also another great way to find people.
Yeah, I and how those friendships can progress from, you know, online only to interacting more and then meeting in person. And yeah, it just feels very like it's nice to know sometimes that, you know, you're not alone in this journey, because most of the time you're just alone with like, you know, these weird voices in your head.
Yes, exactly that.
And then you meet other people who also have weird voices in their head, and you're like, oh my God, you get
Yeah, that's so true.
it. Yeah. Well, and I know, like, I met you actually a long time ago on Bookstagram. You know, and before you were published, you know, you actually built up quite a large following within the Bookstagram community. And I know social media is one of those things that authors either love or hate, right? Like they either like
Yeah.
the dreaded social media, or they find a knack at it. I wonder how has that changed for you from before you were published to now being a published author?
Yeah, I actually think it's really funny how you put it with the like, you either love or hate it. I feel like I have felt all the things at different points in time. So it's been
Yeah.
more of like shifting from one mode to another. I did have a really hard time when I went from kind of being a bookstagrammer or primarily a reader online to being a writer. I think just that discomfort that I think a lot of authors feel in talking about their own work, feeling like you're always talking about yourself. And like,
Yeah.
I was very uncomfortable with that for a while. And so it was really hard for me to talk about my books. Although I will also add that part of that was probably because I had like a small child and then another small child, and I was just tired overall, so that may have also been a contributing factor. But
Probably.
yeah, but there was a time sort of after, like in that during that shift, I guess, from Bookstagram to being an author, where I really kind of hated social media for a while, just because it was like, I want to talk about me. Like I don't want to do that. But eventually I started understanding that, like, no matter what, you're gonna have to learn how to pitch your books eventually. Like, that's just, that's something you can't escape if you're going to be a book author. 'Cause, like, I also write short fiction, and you don't really have to pitch your short fiction. That's not really a problem when you're writing short fic. But if it's your book, you can't really get away from that. And I think once I really got into, like, trying out pitching different ways and like talking about all the fun parts of the book and just realizing that it's really just sharing all the reasons that you loved writing that book in the first place, like what drew you to that story. It felt a little different. I was like, oh, I could just talk about things that I like writing and reading also. And yeah, and then eventually I also probably spend a little too much time in Canva and kind of got I actually got into doing that part of it though. It was like it felt a little bit celebratory in a way to be able to take, or indulgent maybe is a better word, to take the time to be like, no, I just want to make a fun little reel that's like some mood pictures that have to do with my book, and I want to do like a little pitch trailer and stuff like that. And like it takes a while, so it does feel indulgent sometimes, but I don't know. Stuff like that really helped me.
Celebratory.
Yeah. It just helped me be like, no, I wrote this book. I did a thing and now I'm proud of it and I can put it out in the world. So my relationship has moved back to enjoying it in that sense. Because I just kind of go for like what I'm excited about. And I don't worry too much about platforms that are just not my thing. Like I don't really force myself to spend a lot of time on kind of secondary platforms or stuff like that, and just stick with what I like. And now I kind of enjoy it.
I think that that's actually really important, like, because I think that, you know, so many people look at it as an obligation, right? Like, you have to pump your books and you have to do this and you have to do that. And I love that you were able to kind of find, like, first, I love celebratory. Like, because I just think that we don't celebrate things enough. Like, and why shouldn't indulgent also be something that you celebrate? Like, I don't think that that has to be a four-letter word, as it were. But like finding how do you do that? Because I think that, you know, one thing is understanding like what readers also want. And I don't know if you felt this, but I kind of feel like I've always, as a reader, really enjoyed kind of those behind the scenes, you know, kind
Yes,
of
me
seeing.
too.
And I think sometimes in promotion we look at it too much of like buy this book instead of like you said, here's a peek behind the curtain, so to speak.
I know, like, especially before I was published, before I had an agent, I was always very interested in seeing authors do those kind of posts. So definitely I know, like, as an aspiring writer, I felt that way.
And do you feel like, your audience did you, because I think this is a fear too, is that if you build up an audience, as a quote unquote reader or fan or whatever, and then you switch to being an author, did you notice a change in like tone, or was it pretty consistent?
I haven't really had a problem with that, but I do. It's actually more in sort of like my own choice in how I interact with people that's changed. Because I used to go to a lot of author events just as a fan, as a reader, and go and, go online and meet authors that I admired and tell them how much I love their books. And I still do that, but it's different now. Like, I approach other authors as sort of like co-workers in a sense, in a larger sense, I guess. And just talk author to author, which feels a little bit different. But I haven't really found that to be any kind of like difficult shift with Bookstagram. I feel like, I have a lot of reader friends on Bookstagram, people who aren't trying to write or anything like that, who are purely readers, and they are generally pretty excited to see like kind of one of their own, I guess, become an author. So that's been really nice. I've felt very, very well supported in that community. And, I think a lot of authors who meet me now on there probably don't really know that I used to be a Bookstagrammer, and that's fine, but it's kind of fun to like, I don't know, I haven't really felt like I'm locked out of that space now or anything like that.
Well, that's good. I think maybe that'll come as a relief. I think that you've given people a different way of looking at it, perhaps. So that's
Hope so.
always nice. So you had mentioned, you also write the short fiction, which is obviously a completely different world from traditional publishing, but you also have like published within small press spaces. You've shifted more towards that traditional publishing, first with your YA thriller, now an adult horror. How have those experiences in these different formats shaped your writing?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to think about here, so I'll probably mention a few different things.
Yeah, totally.
So for one, I do read very widely across categories and genres, which I think helps. I think that can be pretty beneficial to the actual storytelling itself, because you can see different genre conventions, kind of play around with them, find inspiration in one space that can carry over to another. So I feel like playing around with those expectations and elements has helped me hopefully keep my writing fresh
Yeah.
and, just inject some kind of like new ideas into different genres. And I think like, so working with different publishers and publishers of different sizes has been a really, really interesting experience. Like, I mean, for one, just like the different editors, this one is less about like the size of the imprint or anything, but different editors will notice different things. And I've been lucky enough to work with a few different people who I feel like are helping me learn different things with my storytelling, because like one person is very theme focused, another is really good at looking at, looking for plot holes and kind of keeping mystery elements really tight. Another person might be very character focused and like encourages me to, bring out different elements of like a character's backstory. So I feel like for one, just sheer like working with different people has been very, very helpful for me. It's also very interesting to see like how different publishers do things differently, because like some of the stuff is the same no matter what. You're going to have a book at the end of it, and like there's like certain things that don't really change. But I have noticed that kind of the smaller the publisher is, generally in my experience, the more collaborative they are when it comes to the sort of like marketing, publicity, promotion. And honestly, like that's not a value judgment. It's not necessarily good or bad. It sort of depends on the goals and what you want, though. Like with small press, if you're not really interested in being part of the marketing and kind of like helping get the word out, it's going to be a lot harder. Whereas like with some of the big five, for example, some of them are just machines. They got it all covered, basically. And sometimes they prefer if you just let them be and like don't try to like mess with their system, because they're like, no, we know what we're doing, we got this. And so I feel like people have different levels of like how involved they want to be with that sort of promotion and publicity, collaboration, marketing, all that stuff. And so where they fit in terms of the publisher size can be that in part.
That's really interesting what you said about like learning different things from different people, because I do think for a lot of authors out there, sort of like the dream is you get an agent, right? But then you get an editor, right? You get someone that just sort of stays with you for your whole career. And I think it's interesting to think about, because in on the one hand, like, yes, that's obviously like good as you grow and like develop a relationship with them, because I think relationships are very important and end up being very communal in a way. But then also, like you mentioned, for a debut author, it's sort of interesting to get that wide range, kind of like why you want to read in other genres, right? Like you might want to work with other people. That's actually really interesting. I don't think I've ever really thought about that.
I mean, it's not something that I thought too much about until, well, okay, part of it for me is I just like writing differently. I get bored if I'm writing something that's too similar all the time. Although I say that, and I have like three-fourths of my books are haunted houses, basically. So there's certain
But
elements
different
that do.
haunted houses.
Yeah, there's definitely certain elements that do carry through, but I think that it is really, there is something that is pretty cool about working with different people. I think you can also get that to some degree with working with a wide range of beta readers or critique partners. It doesn't necessarily have to be an editor. I've just found that like my editorial experiences have been really fascinating that way.
It's a character study on its own.
Yeah, basically.
A haunted house with an editor, perhaps, is on the table. Maybe. Well, I want to shift a little bit to your new book, Demon Song, speaking of haunted houses of a sort. Where did this idea first come from?
I don't know if you wanted me to like mention what Demon Song's about first. I could do that, or
You can, it's your interview. Yeah.
okay,
Tell us about it.
yeah, I just figure that'll probably help a little bit with explaining the backstory. So I consider it like a Phantom of the Opera meets The Haunting of Hill House. It is a haunted Beijing opera house novella in which a teen and her mom get jobs under the table as cleaners in exchange for room and board at a centuries old at this again the centuries old Beijing opera house. And then soon the teen finds herself having strange dreams, finds strange secret passageways in the opera house, and all of it leads her closer to something hungry that lives deep within. It also includes some Chinese mythology, the Monkey King, all that. So that is Demon Song.
Very good. Very interesting.
And where it comes from is it started with Phantom of the Opera. It is a story that I've loved for a long time. It's the first musical I ever watched live, and it just really stuck with me over the years. And
Yeah, it was the first one I ever watched live too, I think.
really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. Yeah, it's just such a beautiful and deeply resonant story. I feel like that's one of those stories that, like, I don't know, I just can't stop thinking about. So among those ponderings, one thing that I wondered is what it must be like for Meg Geary, watching her best friend Christine Daae sort of rise to fame very suddenly and in this huge way. And I just thought that must be such an interesting like relationship or friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I also like Meg's mother is Madame Giry, the opera house madam.
Yeah.
And to me, that was such a fascinating relationship. Like, she's such the, you know, Madame Giry is such a morally gray character. Like, in some ways, she's almost encouraging Christine's very messed up relationship with the Phantom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and like, both, as far as we can tell, like, Meg and Christine both live in the opera house with, you know, with Madame Giry. And, you know, I just wondered if some part of it was that she is protecting her own child and almost sacrificing someone else to the Phantom. And you also find,
Oh, that's interesting.
yeah, and like you also find out that, you know, she was part of the Phantom's backstory, right? Like she helped him become the Phantom of the Opera, essentially. And I just think, like, I don't know, it's such an interesting relationship. Like, there's a lot there. And so I think
Yes.
that kind of caught hold somewhere in my mind. And I wanted to tell a story from Meg's perspective. And so my main character, Megan, is based on Meg. And then I thought, okay, what if I made the opera house a Chinese opera house? And, you know, added in some Monkey King mythology because I love, you know, putting folklore in my stories.
Yes.
And then kind of approached themes of like what it's like to be part of the Chinese diaspora and, you know, being in a country where you're not fluent in the main, like in the language that's spoken around you. Because my main character, Megan, is Chinese American and she is in Beijing and she knows some Mandarin, but she's not fluent in it, which is like my own experience. And that part of it is also based on my own experience of like the first time I went to China when I was 15 years old and all those feelings. So, yeah, so all of that sort of swirled together into what I originally thought was going to be a short story.
As she laughs.
Yeah, it was literally okay. This might be like more backstory than you want, but my very first published short story was in Classic Monsters Unleashed, where they took like, you know, a classic monster from one of these tales, and then, you know, you write like a new short story about it. The limit was 5,000 words, and this was originally an idea for that.
I
And
love
so I
it.
was like, I could totally write this in 5,000 words. And then I tried to actually write it. And
Great.
yeah, now it is 35,000. So I guess it wanted to be a little bit longer. But yeah, so this is one of those weird stories that just like it started out shorter. And then the next version, I was like, okay, I'll write a novelette. And that was, I don't know, 12,000 words or something. And then it was like, I saw a novella call. I was like, well, maybe I'll try making it a novella. And I don't know, somehow, some way, it ended up being a long novella. So,
Yeah.
here
Yeah,
we are.
it got longer.
Yeah, this one really like existed at so many different lengths at different points in time.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of, interesting that, sometimes you have an idea for a story and then it just sort of like the story wants to be what it wants to be
Yeah,
sometimes.
I mean, and it really was through the end of it, because even the version of this book that went out on submission, which for anyone who doesn't know what that is, that's when your agent takes the book out to editors to see if someone wants to buy it. When it went out on submission, it was 25,000 words. And so I added another 10,000 in revisions with my editor.
Well, sometimes, that's how it goes. I think it's again kind of heartening maybe for new authors to realize, because I think so often you hear cut, 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 that you just have to cut. Sometimes, when you work with an editor, you also grow a story in different ways.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it really depends on the editor and the space and kind of like what your target audience is, I feel.
Yeah. I'm so glad that like you kind of mentioned the mythology and the folklore, because that is one thing that I think, readers of your work will notice immediately. Like there is always this, whether it's mythology or folklore or both, they're woven in, and not just, as sort of an add-on, but they're very like, and they're an intricate part of the story. And they come across as very natural to the story, I find. And I think this is an interesting conversation sometimes online. How do you approach balancing sort of that quote unquote teaching the reader versus telling the story, like finding that balance between that?
I really appreciate this question because this is something that I think a lot about. And I guess, like, and I've tried different sort of levels of like what you're saying, teaching and telling. I think for me, for one thing, some of these stories are new to me and some of them aren't. And about like, because, I grew up in the US and a lot of these stories are not that easy to find in English. And so it actually, like, part of it for me is I'm actually going and learning some of these mythologies myself while I'm researching for it. It's almost an excuse to take some time to like learn some of this Chinese folklore and mythology. Well, other stories I did grow up with. So for me, it's a very, very interesting thing to see because, like, I don't think that everybody, like, I don't think that anyone is required to explain all the ins and outs of mythology, whether or not they think their audience will be familiar with it. I think that's a very personal choice. But for me, as somebody who is still discovering those stories, I feel like I lean a little bit more toward making it clearer to readers who might be like me, who also are very interested but may not have come across this particular story in childhood. So that's one thing that I would say. But also, I think when it comes to like how much I actually tell, it really depends on that piece of mythology or folklore's like relationship to this particular story. So, for example, in Demon Song, I include the story of Sun Wukong and Bai Guqing, which is like the Monkey King and the White Bone Demon. And in that, I decided to basically retell it from the demon's perspective, because that would be a little bit different than, most folklore tales are not centering the bone. So I thought that would be a way to sort of make it hopefully fresh and interesting, even to somebody who is already familiar with it. But the other thing too is like, I'm going to tell that story because it's really, really central to this novella. Whereas, in it, there are some other pieces of mythology mentioned, like Chang'e, the moon lady, and, some of the other like goddesses and gods from Chinese mythology. And in those cases, I don't always go into the details of the story because it's a passing reference. It's not something you need to understand in order to understand the story, like the novella. So that's usually where I kind of draw my line, but it just, yeah. So it really depends on the context.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I love rewriting it from, I mean, I always like rewriting from the point of view of the villain. That's
It's
always
fun.
a winning strategy in my book. So, what do you hope, if anything, readers take away from your writing?
I generally just hope that they're left thinking about something at the end of it. It doesn't even matter what exactly, or like, if they like or didn't like it or whatever, like that's fine. But I'm always really happy when I can leave readers just thinking about some element of it. Maybe like a relationship between characters, things like that. I just find that part really, really interesting. And I try to aim for kind of complex relationships, ones that are not, oh, it, where it's not always clear cut who is like right or wrong and who is the villain or not, sometimes even. And I hope that leaves people thinking.
I love it. You're fairly new in your career, so perhaps this question is a little premature, but what's been the biggest surprise of your writing career so far?
I think it's honestly how hard it is. Like, I don't want to be depressing or anything. I don't want to discourage anyone because obviously I'm still here. I'm gonna keep trying. I'm gonna keep doing my best to stay in as long as people will let me. But it was a little bit surprising to me just because I don't consider myself particularly insecure or emotionally fragile, which again, like, no shade. Like, that's, you are who you are, and people, that's not something that is usually in anyone's control. It's more that it just caught me off guard because I kind of thought, like, oh, I can handle it, whatever.
Right,
And
yeah.
sometimes, yeah, but there are some pretty tough moments. There's some stuff you really have to like. There are moments that come up inevitably where you sort of have to decide how much you really want this. How badly do you want to stay in? Because there's always going to be things about it that are hard. Like,
Yeah.
no matter what. I don't think I know any authors who have been in for a few years who haven't experienced those things in some
Yeah.
form or other. It's just, it's a volatile industry. There's a lot going on. So yeah, I guess that was probably just the biggest surprise that personally I had to keep making that choice again and again, but I did, and I plan to continue to do so. I want to stay in. I want to I want to be here in 5 years and 10 years and hopefully beyond that.
Yeah, I love that you said that. Because I don't know that people talk about that a lot. That you kind of have to face a moment where you decide, because I feel like sometimes this industry can feel so subjective and like so much is out of your control. But then again, like there is also a choice of do you even want to continue like fighting that fight, I guess.
I think that it can be really hard to talk about because a lot of times it's a very personal thing for people. And I think there's also this push in the industry to sort of always put on a brave face about it and just be like,
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah.
it's great. So it
Only
is what
focus on the positive and yeah, don't talk about that.
Yeah. And I also think too, like, it can be in a way difficult to talk about just because so many people want to be in the industry, and I get it. I also have been there for many, many years, just like doing everything I could to try to break in. And it can be difficult to break in, as I'm sure every writer knows. And so because of that, like, you don't want to make it seem like you don't appreciate what you have, because I definitely, definitely do. But I also think that sometimes that doesn't just cancel out all the difficult parts.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And I think takes us to our final question beautifully, which is, do you have any advice for new or aspiring writers?
Yeah, this is real advice, but I also like, I don't mean it to sound facetious, but figure out how to stay in, figure out how to keep going, figure out how to keep writing. And for me, that is often things that are like celebrate every single win. Like when I would get, when I'd send out short stories, if I get a hold on it, as in like they may still reject it later, but they at least want to hold it for consideration, I celebrate that. Like, if you get a request from an agent, celebrate that. Like, to me, it's about taking these moments. And like I said with the social media, like, take some time to be like, no, I'm really proud of this book. I am going to give myself an hour or a few hours to just like make this cool little video about it because I'm really proud of what I did. I think just finding those ways to make sure you're hanging on to the joy is actually, to me, the most important thing, and just like finding ways to continue writing, whether that's like sometimes that means changing your methodology partway through writing a book. Like you're like, oh, I'm gonna write it this way. And then somewhere along the way, it stops working. It was working for the first third, but now it's not anymore. And just like trying something new and being okay with that. And I guess that sort of relates to my other, I don't even know if this is a piece of advice, but it helps if you can try to learn to be flexible. I think it's a really hard thing. Like, I am a planner. I like to know my schedule ahead of time. I like to know what's coming up ahead. And it's definitely taken me some time to get used to the unpredictability of publishing. It's like, your book is not done when you turn it in. You do your own edits and you send it to your agent, if you're doing traditional publishing, and then you edit with your agent, and then now you're on submission. Yay! But also, if someone buys it, now you're probably doing like one or two developmental edit rounds, one or two line edit rounds. Now you're doing maybe one or two copy edit rounds, a few rounds of past pages. Like, there's all these little things, and you often can't do anything about when that happens. Like they'll be like, okay, copy edits are here and you have a week. Drop everything. You know, and I don't, again, I don't say that to be discouraging. It's more like, I think it just helps me to understand, like, okay, there's uncertainty here, but if you just figure out some ways to kind of like be as flexible as you can about it, it makes it easier. Like, because for me, I feel like at first it was very frustrating that I wasn't always getting, and you know, that I didn't always have like a timeline. I didn't know when edits were coming. I didn't know when this is happening. I was trying to plan. And now I'm like, okay, no, it will all happen at some point, and I will just deal with it when it happens. Like, just learning to be a little more okay with that sort of spontaneity, I guess, and uncertainty. I don't know if that's
Well,
advice though, but yeah.
I think that's actually good advice. Yeah. So keep the joy, stay in it, be flexible. That can
Yeah,
put
just find whatever ways you can. And again, that's like, that can be community. That can be, you know, I don't know, just like letting yourself have an afternoon off to watch TV because you just finished a cool thing, you know, like you finished writing a chapter and now you get a little treat.
love it. Well, thank you so much for coming back on our show. I had a wonderful time talking to you, as always.
You too. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you guys like haunted houses with some Phantom of the Opera, definitely check out Demon Song.
Thanks.
The things I like love about Kelsea as a human being is how she's learned to embrace celebration. And I really, really loved how she used that to turn her experience of social media around, especially going from a reader-focused Instagram page to sort of the more obligatory buy my book. And I was just wondering how you guys celebrate your wins. Like, what do you do to kind of keep that joy in this often joyless business going?
Bourbon. And ironically, when I don't succeed, also bourbon.
Cake.
I don't know which is worse, cake or bourbon. Probably bourbon. I don't know. Can you make cake out of bourbon? There you
Oh,
go.
you can make a
Yes,
bourbon
you
cake.
can. Whiskey
I
cake
can
is a
do that.
thing. Whiskey cake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really bad at doing this. I'm just like, I did that, and then I just write the next thing.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I know. I'm bad at celebrating too, but I'm trying to do it more and more, and I do think it helps, weirdly, or not
Yeah.
weirdly.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at it. We hardly celebrate anything. We probably should.
Yeah.
I was in kind of like a little clutch of writers support group, just some fellow thriller writers, and we made a rule that you celebrate every victory no matter how small. And so if you got a mention on Twitter from somebody, you say we celebrated that in the group, you know. So I think it's more than just celebrating. You need to find the right people to celebrate. You
Yeah.
know.
Yeah, that's true.
I did really like her take on social media because I'm always like, I hate being that buy my book kind of person, you know?
Yeah.
But just, you know, sharing the reasons you love writing the book and what you drew you to it, all that behind the scenes stuff. I think that's a good approach. Because, like you said, I
Yeah.
like that. I like to know all
Right.
the.
Yeah, it's fun to watch and to see that side of it. But I guess that's so interesting that as a reader, you can love watching those things, but then when the cameras turned, so to speak, like
You're like,
it's very difficult to do for whatever. We're like, oh, nobody cares, but we know as a reader they care. It's a weird psychology.
yeah, because it does feel indulgent, right? And we're kind of, I don't know, like you're taught not to, some of us are taught like not to draw attention on yourself, and that's not polite. And so then it feels weird and uncomfortable, and you're like, nobody cares about me, but they do because you care about it as a reader. So,
That's the
yeah.
great irony of this show. Like the whole point, we're talking to people, getting kind of there behind the scenes, right? And I get approached by authors all the time who want to be on these podcasts. And then you run across somebody who's like, yeah, I'm a big fan of the show. But they won't promote their own stuff. They won't talk about it. Nobody wants to hear, you know, what I went through or my struggle. Like I have an entire show built around that idea.
I, it's interesting. I'm gonna have to Christine, you're the neuropsychologist. You're going to have to dig into the psychology behind that, like why we do that. Because I do think it's a fascinating quirk of people that we do that.
How long do you have?
I'll get with you after the show.
Okay.
Another thing I really like about, both her short fiction and her novellas and now two of her novels are that they always incorporate, some element of like Chinese folklore or Chinese mythology, but in a way that like really makes sense to the story and is sort of accessible. Do you guys, I know Kevin, you probably do with like your artifacts, but JD and Christine, do you also like ever incorporate like sort of like myths into your stories? And then how do you handle that so that the reader doesn't feel left out without like info dumping? Because that's kind of a hard line, I think, sometimes.
Myth? No. I don't think I ever have. I'm thinking about it. I'm like, no, I don't think I have done
How
that.
about myth information?
No, I love the idea of
Wow.
mining side characters or very minor characters from other stories for a new story, though.
Oh,
Oh,
I love that.
yeah,
So
that's
I'm
fun.
like, that would be cool. If I found the right one, I would do that. I just can't, I don't think I have. I can't.
Yeah, like a retelling.
Oh, I guess, yeah, like
But
early on, I kind of did and took some bits and pieces from other myths like Lamia, kind of
yeah.
Judeo-Christian
Yeah, I
mythology,
guess
but
a little
yeah.
bit with hats, right? I mean, I guess are we gonna call the Bible mythology?
I
I
guess, yeah,
will.
I guess
Why
that
not?
depends on your take on that. So yes, I did mind the Bible, which I do a lot. I grew up a preacher's kid, so I can't help that, but
I did it in Dracul. There's an
yeah.
Irish vampire legend called the Derridu, which it's about a woman. She was basically locked in a tower, and she threw herself out of the tower and killed herself and turned into a vampire. So like we stole bits and pieces of this legend, but we made it a true story in Dracul, like an actual person that Bram Stoker knew, and kind of tied it all into that, which makes it fun because when you're reading it, you can go out there, you can Google a lot of this stuff, and you realize a lot of it is actually based on the truth. I like mixing that type of thing in,
Yeah.
but that's probably the extent of it.
And I know, Jenna, that you excluded me from the question
Well,
immediately,
I
but
didn't exclude you. I just know quite a lot,
and
and
I do,
so
and that, yeah, it's a core part of the archaeological thrillers, but the I do kind of what JD did. So I intermingle actual factual mythology and history with stuff I just made up. And what's shocking to me is how often I'll get notes from readers saying, "Oh, yeah, I went and looked that up, and I had no idea about, all this entire list of things, right?" Like I literally made like 80% of that up. Like somehow it was real. So anyway,
archetype.
that's my
I
story.
love that as a reader, honestly. I mean, I love both. I love when it feels so real, but then it isn't. Like, I think that's like kind of interesting. Like, you're
Yeah.
like, did this really happen? And you go Google it and you're like, ah,
Oh, my. Yeah.
author.
I've probably talked about this. My favorite was when my mom asked me if I actually thought Abraham Lincoln was a vampire hunter. And I'm like, no, mom, I don't think he actually was.
100%,
You can't prove
100%
that he
true
wasn't.
story.
But that's convincing fiction, right?
And Teddy Roosevelt.
All right. I guess with that, I should ask JD who is up next week.
Next week, we've got Ariel Sullivan on. Ariel grew up a military brat, moving every 2 or 3 years. As a perpetual new kid, she basically observed the world as an outsider and often found herself lost in books. She's here to tell us all about her latest novel. It's called Conform. It's actually the first novel from Jenna Bush Hager's latest venture called A Thousand Voices. So that's going to be interesting. Ariel Sullivan.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersinkpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersinkpodcast.com.